and welcome back to the Football New South Wales Community Podcast, covering all things related to the football family at local and community level. My name's Teo Pelizzeri. It's great to join you for another edition. And on this edition, we have a feature guest for the duration of the podcast. Co-hosting with me today is the General Manager of Hills Football, Charlotte Ursell. Charlotte, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
It's great to have another General Manager of an association here with us because we get to hear the specifics to your region. And there are so many issues that are specific but are also uniform across the entire state, and you start to pick up a trend the more people we have sit with us here. So thank you for continuing our series of conversations with key decision makers and key people, providing football to tens of thousands of people in New South Wales. Tell us, how long have you been the General Manager at Hills Football and how long have you been with the association?
So again, thank you for having me. And I'm sure the other General Managers that you've spoken to have probably said similar things, so I don't like to repeat myself, but it will be super relevant to the current issue. So at Hills, in the role as General Manager, 2 years. I think I've just hit 3 years in total. So I was in a slightly different role and I essentially have been promoted after a year. So Matt Rippon was the previous General Manager, which we all know as well. He also worked here at Football New South Wales. So during that time, I've kind of covered all bases, I think. So the previous role before that at Hills was member services. So working with the clubs, inclusion, diversity was thrown into the mix in female football. So yeah.
And for you personally, always in sports administration, or did you change paths in order to, you know, pursue being an executive in sports administration? What was the background before football?
I mean, like all others, we have many hats and I still have to juggle those hats. So I guess whilst being a sports administrator, I'm also a coach, which a lot of people are kind of familiar with, maybe not. It's always been the plan to be in a role like this. So unfortunately, we do have to sacrifice a couple of things, and that is coaching. I still am coaching at the moment. I'm with the Parramatildas as assistant coach. I do a couple of other things locally as well within the association. So I'm also running coaching courses at the moment. So that's always helpful.
Now, it's important for our wider audience, especially ones listening from out of state, but also in other parts of the state. Hills Football, what's your territory? Where are your boundaries? And what are some of the familiar suburbs that people even listening from outside of your part of Sydney would know?
Yeah, so Hills Football, to keep it simple, and thankfully for us, we do follow the majority of the boundary of Hillshire Council. We do have, I think it's about 6 fields that are outside of the area, just in the Parramatta Council. So we go from as far as, Winton Hills, North Rocks, on one side in Baulkham Hills, and then all the way up to Box Hill, which is a new untouched market. That's where all our new playing venues will be in the next couple of years. So that's more of the north ward where the growth is. So centrally where we are right now, just across the way, is our office in Bella Vista. So that's more of a central area in Castle Hill. And then again, just leading more towards, Kenthurst, Galston, those types of areas at the furthest other point of the boundary.
So how many registered players are we looking at for the association, and would you be able to give us a breakdown of sort of divisions or clubs, or how you like to categorise your participation base?
Yes, we are all very different. Every association has a different setup. So we have 20 member clubs. Within those member clubs, you know, there's some very small clubs, there's some very large clubs. So we're quite lucky there's a bit of diversity across the board. So 20 member clubs. Our membership, we've just hit 14,000 this year. I think the last number we recorded on yesterday, so every Monday we basically look at the numbers, and we've just hit, I think, 14,333, I think. It could be a little bit different because it's been a couple of days, so the numbers are rolling in. It's quite scary, actually. It's a good thing, obviously, but we hit 13,000 this time last year, and, you know, it's the first time we've ever reach those scary numbers. So the numbers are continuing to go up. Summer football, we're close to 3,000. So across summer and winter, we've gone up by 1,000, and that's capping numbers as well. So it's a good problem to have, but it's scary at the same time. And I think overall growth, and again, I think this is across the board, so I'm sure everyone else has said it within other regions, we're about 10% up as a total, and then in the female space, where I think it's 25% up female growth numbers. So also excellent coming off the back of a successful Women's World Cup.
That is something we'll circle back to, but I wanted to, with regards to the geography, ask you about the things that you notice about having some of your membership in heavily urbanised area and then suburbia and then expansion corridor. So you got to, would it be right to say you've got a bit of a mix of all three? Yes. And tracking demographic change is actually a key part of assessing where to target for fields, for clubs, for growth?
Yes. So the areas I mentioned probably at one point, more the Baulkham Hills, North Rocks, even where we're situated at the moment, Castle Hill as well, they're heavily dense areas, so there's no identified sites or new playing venues, so to speak. So those clubs are quite large already, so they are relatively good at capping their numbers. And then in the furthest point being, I suppose, Rouse Hill Rams, they're also very capped. But beyond Rouse Hill Rams leading into the North Ward, is technically what it's called, there's growth of, I think, 77,000 new people moving into the area in the next 10 years. So those Box Hill sites, North Kellyville, up until our boundaries, which is basically up until Riverston, that goes, obviously, as we know, into the Blacktown Association, that's where it's an untouched market. That's where the growth is. So we go from one side where it's fully capped, no new fields, no space, essentially, up until, I guess, like I mentioned, that North Ward, where we've got about, I think in the next couple of years, we should have about 6 or 7 new venues up and running. A new growing area brings new families, so different demographics as well. For anyone that's familiar with, I suppose, Schofields and Riverston, new families, young families, so to speak. We do have an ageing population as well, so we're quite blessed. But those ageing populations are more in the Kenthurst, I guess, Baulkham Hills type of areas. So in terms of opportunities, in terms of grants, even smaller grants, we find that those grants are more so looked at in those newer areas, which is probably the bad side of it. But, you know, we're looking forward to what we can do in those new areas.
And as far as, you know, boots on the ground and sort of the battle for, you know, attention, funding, space, are we talking football daylight number one, or are we talking rugby league heartland as well, swimming, athletics, cricket, what have you? Where does football stand? Because a lot of people just assume the west of Sydney is football heartland. Would you say that rings true for the Hills Association?
I think so, yeah. We are the biggest participation sport across the state, as we know, but within the Hills, it's alarming, actually, compared to the numbers of the other sports. So we do have quite an interesting area in the sense that our council allocates a centre of excellence for each major sport. So unfortunately, as the biggest participation sport, we're the last to receive a centre of excellence, so to speak. So the NRL, AFL, cricket, they all kind of have that. If not, it's coming online in the next couple of years. Probably the next closest sport, I would think, is NRL. We do have the Eels as well. The Parramatta Eels are located within our boundary, so they're at Kellyville Park. They're doing great things there. So we actually work collaboratively with the other sports as well, just working on, I guess, future projects. So we're not really in competition with them. So simple answer is yes. To answer your question, yes, the football is the biggest sport, and, you know, we're screaming for more fields because the access and the demand is, you know, it's quite prevalent. So we know that there's more participants there. They might be playing other sports, or they might be doing both sports. We're not too sure, but the demand is definitely there. And again, we do work collaboratively with the other sports, cricket as well. I won't really talk too much about cricket, but we do work with those clubs as well to get further access in the summer months if we need to.
The size of the Hills Association, so your staff that you're in charge of, how big is your organisation, and what's been sort of the evolution of the size of your organisation in order to provide what you do?
So staffing wise, I'm general manager, so I oversee kind of everything and anything, which is always a fun time. It brings many challenges, if you will, but, you know, that's part of what we do. We do have 6 full-time staff members, soon to be 7. We've got 3 part-timers, actually, and we've got, I think, a pool of maybe 20 to 30 casual staff members. So delivery on the ground is, it's exploding. So our clubs are also, asking for further opportunities for us to facilitate different programs, initiatives, everything and anything on the ground, which is why we've got such a large casual base. In terms of staff within the office, you know, we've got someone looking after every area, and we are working quite closely with our Pathways club, which is Hills United. So I'm sure everyone's well versed in the NPL space and all the programs and initiatives that they're facilitating as well. So the more that we collaborate with them and come together and deliver or co-deliver on the pitch and off the pitch, the more that we actually need more staff as well, because everything's kind of working together and it is becoming more streamlined. So
let's go back to participation. Take us back over some of the numbers and the real success stories that you've tracked year on year that really show how much football is taking off, and particularly in the women's and girls space.
So with the women's, as mentioned, you know, 25% up this year, which I think is also across the board, but for us specifically, it has been quite a challenge. We do have probably five or six clubs that do it really well, and they're generally our bigger clubs, and they've got the facilities to do that. So over the years, we do see a small growth, but the biggest growth, as you can expect, is in the men's space. So what we have been trying to do is run social programs. So Kick On For Women, you know, it's run across the board as well. So we ran our first one with a club called Hill Spirit. They then transitioned into an over 30 ladies team. So we're trying to look at more social elements to grow female football. We do run female coaching courses, referee courses as well, and we do have networks as well. So a female referee network and a female coaching network as well to help foster that space. There's so many unlimited opportunities in terms of what our clubs want to do as well. It's just trying to find a way to, I guess, manage that and encourage it as well. And you know, again, with my coaching hat on, I do put on the boots occasionally to make sure that, you know, there's a female role model out there if need be. And we do have, you know, a 50-50 split in the office actually as well. So that's always helpful and encouraging. So, you know, our clubs can also see female leaders within the workplace. So I guess separate to that, we are trying to manipulate in a positive light our female-only competitions as well. So for the first time ever, we've introduced an under-8s female-only competition. Historically, it's each year or every 2 years we try and bring the age slightly lower. It can be challenging. A lot of females do play other sports like netball. Sounds very stereotypical, but that's what the stats tell us. So they like to play on Sundays and then they play netball on Saturdays. A lot of them also like to play on Saturdays with their friends or their brothers, whatever it may be, and playing a mixed team. So we just encourage all participation. So as long as the opportunities and options are there, and we support the clubs in that, in providing them either guidance or advice, whatever it may be, then that's the main thing that we're looking at doing.
Stay with me on this, because I guess everyone knew the Women's World Cup was coming and could brace. I guess you see the tsunami approaching the shoreline and you might be prepared, but you don't really know until the wave hits. So how would you say that if you had to assess how your association has managed the demand, would you say that, you know, everything went exactly as you might have anticipated, or have there been unforeseen challenges that have appeared that you've had to, you know, problem solve along the way?
I think with female football, it's very hard to measure. And I know that sounds a bit ridiculous, but you can't quite pinpoint if it's to the success of a tournament like the Women's World Cup. It's similar to the previous year with the Men's World Cup. So we knew that there would be an explosion of growth in summer football regardless, but I think that also comes off the back of, you know, two COVID-affected years. We had a washed out, potentially almost half of our season washed out the year before that as well. So yes, we are reaping the benefits of the Women's World Cup. We can try and connect it to the success of the tournament as well. I think there's also just general interest, and I think I can probably summarise it by an interaction that I had in summer football at the back end of 2023 with an under-6s female-only team. Again, entered into a mixed competition as well, so we don't quite split in summer football. Not yet, we probably will for this year. And I was just taking some photos. Everyone's got a new kit. Everyone's happy to be there. This is round one. And talking to some parents, they, you know, you just start having conversation. As you know, I just asked the question, you know, do they play in winter? And what club do they play for if they do? And they said, no, this is the starting point, and they all want to be Matildas. So I think just those types of conversations kind of confirm that, you know, we're reaping the benefits of the success of the Women's World Cup. There's hype across the board. It's, you know, I'm kind of going a little bit off topic here, but you see boys wearing, you know, the Matildas jerseys. I think that also highlights it. So it's not even just in the women's space, it's in the men's space. So I think that will continue. In the women's space, we have unlimited opportunities. Historically, they always play on a Sunday. We do have a over 30 ladies competition on the Friday nights as well. It's in our men's space that we're having some challenges, more so in terms of the numbers. So that's a Saturday generally. But yeah, we're trying to take advantage of that and provide all different social, competitive, again, off the field and on the field type of opportunities for females.
Let's talk about referees as well, because to be able to accommodate 25% increase in participation, you need referees, or you need at least, you know, people becoming referees or taking it up in order to provide, you know, safe, harmonious playing spaces for as many players as possible. What's the progress on the referee front?
So it's a challenge, as we know. Our main issue is a Saturday, and it's mainly because a lot of our referees actually play as well. So we've tried to manipulate some of our competitions to cater to that. So either changing the time of kickoff, it's quite varied. You know, we've got 300 referees, so it's hard to keep track of who plays where and at what time and what clashes. So we have those conversations. In 2023 season, we did have initiatives where we provided free courses, free registration for all new referees. So that was to encourage new referees. Our biggest issue is keeping them. So we know that there's a lot of abuse across the board, and I don't want to get a bit morbid, but, you know, again, talking to other associations, it's not just us. It's very direct, it's very clear that there's a lot of issues on and off the pitch in terms of disciplinary matters, and majority of it, I would say, is towards the match official. So we're trying to do what we can to make sure that they stay in the game. So it's nice to have new referees, but it's also probably more important to keep the ones that we have. So that was in 2023 season. For the 2024 season, our initiatives are more so in relation to, I guess, keeping them, but also ensuring that referees are available and being appointed to games, because it's nice to have, you know, an increase in the number of registered referees, but in terms of being available on a weekend, it's a whole different story. So I guess some of the ones that we've got here, and I'm, you know, I've got a list in front of me. So this is something that we've pushed out in the last week as well, which is online. But if you've completed 40 games as an appointed referee, which most of them probably at this stage going into the weekend probably have done already, they are refunded their uniform costs. And then if you've done 50 games, you get a refund on your registration fee. So we're trying to entice referees and keep them satisfied, so to speak, so that they have a good experience, and we're trying to build the culture of Heels football referees.
Were those initiatives something that you initiated, or was that from IP sharing with other sports or other associations?
That was just us. I actually don't know if other sports or associations do it. I know we did steal one idea, and it was actually one of our clubs that took this up, which is North Rocks, and we have put a bit of a clip out online as well about it. I think Manly, they have an initiative where they have a team referee, so each senior team has to have an appointed or allocated referee that either does a game before or after their scheduled match, which North Rocks, they've kind of taken that initiative, just switched it up a little bit. So they, as a club, have paid for any senior player that wanted to become a referee. They covered the cost of their fees to do that. And in doing that, they would be allocated or appointed to a game either before or after their scheduled playing game. So if they play at 1 o'clock, they'll be appointed to the game at 3 o'clock if it's uncovered. But we try and ensure that that's the case, so that we're actually following through with that initiative.
Now, my type A personality loves a lot of the practical solutions that you've been talking about, especially with regards to rostering and logistics. However, you did mention earlier the Matilda effect and the widespread halo effect that can have. If you had to sort of brainstorm the halo effect of something from, say, government or Football Australia or Football New South Wales about referees, what you can do out of your office, and then the hands-on effect of what your clubs can do setting culture, where do you see the opportunity to make the most headway? Does it have to be something big coming from a national body? Does it have to be something that's really down in the earth, each individual club, specific administrators, educating their coaches, educating their parents. Where do you see the most amount of work that needs to be done in terms of respect for referees?
I think it starts at the top, and by the top I mean FA providing the guidance and kind of drowning out the space that we need to respect our referees. And my biggest thing is, and I do say this a fair bit to members, particularly when I'm on the ground talking to either clubs or other referees, players, whoever it may be, you either have a referee and you respect them or you don't have a referee. That they're basically your two options, because if you're abusing referees, they're not going to want to come back, you know. There's been NPL games that I've been at, even, you know, on the weekend, on Sunday at our Association Youth League game, there was two referees appointed to an AYL game, which is, you know, in terms of the how I'm across how the order, the pecking order is in terms of the appointment of referees. So I know that that's not a good look, and it's probably a poor sign that, you know, there's someone that just doesn't want to be there. It sounds quite negative, but I'm trying to keep light of it. Separate to that, I guess the main thing is just ensuring that, you know, we're drilling it into our members and it's on the ground. So our clubs are very much across all of our initiatives. We did come out pretty hard last year and advise that any incident on the pitch or off the pitch that was in relation to abuse of a match official, there was loading added to their send-off. So if they were suspended for, if it's a minimum of, let's say for, you know, example's sake, that it's a minimum of 5 matches, then we add loading. So it'll be 1 game added on top of that if it's related to a match official. So we were pretty firm about that last year. It is 10 times worse for this season, so it's scary. And in the other realm, it starts at the top in terms of the coaches. We know it starts with the coaches because players, you know, as young as under eight, you know, on a Monday morning, it comes on my plate saying that there's an under eight player abusing an instructing referee, you know, who's probably done minimal training, is trying to be mentored by their club. It's crazy, honestly. It's disheartening. So we know that the education, the behaviour of the coaches and probably parents, and I would say it's probably both of those, is probably what's impacting on the players and how they behave. So it's all encompassing. There's no one real solution. It's just, where do we start?
But blue sky thinking, because I think anyone who's listening to this podcast knows we already have the evidence that whatever solutions are out there, you'll be good at implementing them. But if you had sort of a blank canvas to ask for, I don't know, a PR campaign or some sort of additional resource provision, is there anything that is like actually on top of your wish list, or is it literally just grinding through the case by case and trying to make sure that there are as few spot fires going off as possible?
Yeah, I mean, definitely a PR campaign, but it's got to be drilled into all the players. So it's nice that we put things out on social media, and we'll continue to do that. When I'm not saying it's ineffective, and like I mentioned, we'll continue to do that, and we always have continued to do that throughout the season. But it's more maybe going out and meeting with each team. And I know that sounds a bit crazy because we've got, I think, you know, 450 teams or something ridiculous like that.
That's why I said blank.
Yeah, I know, right? So in an ideal world, if we could go out and meet with all of them, happy days. We know that the clubs are across it, but they need the support. So it's the education on what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. And unfortunately, and I know that some other associations are already doing this, there'll be sanctions on teams. So if it comes to a stage where we need to implement something like other associations who, you know, if there's abuse of a match official, you lose points. If that helps and we see the success of that, and again, we'll lean on our friends around us in other areas to see if that's successful for them, that's probably something that we will do. And we really don't want to, but I think when teams understand that there's something to lose, and it affects their, you know, their placing, and, you know, maybe you won't make finals, then I think that will actually make them realise. So I guess also additional funding is always excellent. We actually pay our referees. We probably pay our referees, I would say, and I don't have the stats, so I won't quote, don't quote me on it, but we pay our referees higher than probably most other associations. And that's, you know, I guess just an initiative that was brought in from the start. And again, we have a very different setup here at the Hills. We don't have a branch, and I know a lot of other associations are bringing that in-house like we do. So we do have a bit more control of I guess, facilitating the fees. We've always been on par with either Football New South Wales community standard fees that go out every year, so the circular that comes out at the start of every season, but we actually have increased that, and we continue to increase that just to be ahead of the game and, you know, support our referees. And I guess the cost of uniforms is probably a big issue, so, you know, if we can get a large grant to cover the cost of referee uniforms, then that would be excellent too. So
let's put a full stop on that conversation and move on to something that has been earmarked as a key topic for today's chat. Hills Home of Football. For the completely uninitiated, what is it? Tell us what this project is.
Yes. So an ongoing project that we've been talking about for a very, very long time, well before my time. So again, I've been here for 3 years, and I think probably just as I started is when we first kind of went out with a submission to council. So it's earmarked for Caddies Creek Stage 2, which for those that are not familiar with the area is, I guess, depending on what you put in Google, it could come up as Beaumont Hills, it could come up as Kellyville. So Stage 1, we already have a club there. So if you look at Stage 2, it's just bush for the moment. So it's floodland, it's an untouched area. We have been working very hard to try and get access to the land. So that's our biggest problem at the moment. So again, for those that don't know, it'll be a centre of excellence, so to speak. So we're one of the only associations that doesn't have a home. So to paint a picture in terms of, I guess, pathways, programs, this is training, games, finals, football, all of our tournaments, we're all spread out everywhere. So not only do we need access to further fields, it's more just having a home. So, you know, as I mentioned before, our office is just across the way in Bella Vista. We've got training at one venue at Bella Vista Public School of an evening. We're also at Hills Grammar, which is in Kenthurst. We're here at Valentine Sports Park as well. We've got programs running at Russell Reserve in Rouse Hill. And then for finals, we're spread across about five or six venues. So this would essentially bring the whole community together, and we'll be able to run, you know, there'll be unlimited options to run whatever we would like, essentially, and we'll have a home to ourselves. So the community feeling isn't quite there within the hills in terms of having our own space that we can call home. So
has the plan for the number of pitches, the size of buildings and so forth evolved over time? Has it always been fairly stable? How would it compare to, say, Valentine Sports Park, Wanderers Football Park, Christie Park, in Northwest Sydney Association? What is actually the blueprint looking like? Or is it evolving to the point where it'll fit once the land is actually released to you?
Yes. I think it has changed. Originally, it was supposed to be at a different site. And again, this is well before my time. And in terms of the current location, it has definitely stayed the same. We do have the ability to work with council, which is excellent, and Daniel Rissick, which I know you'll chat to at some stage around how he's supported us. He's helped us with, you know, site plans and things. But general concept is four fields, two synthetic, two grass. One will be at a NPL standard, so Hills United, as well as Association Youth League with Hills Football, finals football, everything and anything in that space will play on that facility. And we've also got two grass fields, which will be to community standard. So of a weekend, you know, this is how we envision it. Of a weekend, you know, you'll have NPL Youth and Association Youth League, SAP, boys SAP on some of those fields. And then we'll rotate, you know, through the club, so there's an opportunity for everyone to be involved in the, or play at the venue on either the community two grass fields that will be side by side, or the synthetic fields as well.
The lobbying, the relationships, the business case. Dare I ask how many hours of work has gone in, and how many people you've engaged along this process?
Yeah, can you see the bags under my eyes? That'll probably explain it. Look, we do have a subcommittee, so we've got a subcommittee for almost every area of the business. So we have a home of football subcommittee, and we have a pathways subcommittee, which they talk to themselves. We've got some very high-profile people, thankfully, within the Hills, particularly on our board and the Hills United committee as well. So we've been working hard together to advocate for this. In that, I guess, current stage is we're still pushing for access to the land. That's our biggest problem. Whilst we've been doing that over the last couple of years, you know, we're working on a business plan to seek funding. Unfortunately, we can't actually apply for any grants. So I know that there's been, you know, the Level the Playing Field grant, there's you know, that's just to name one. Any of the legacy grants throughout the last 12 months that were out or rolled out during the Women's World Cup, we can't apply for because everything has to be shovel ready. So until we can pick up a shovel, we unfortunately can't apply for funding. So in the background, we've been working on designs, obviously our business plan, putting things on everyone's radar. So we also went out with a campaign, I think maybe 2 weeks ago, in the form of a video message, and we'll be working with our clubs to essentially do the same. So to get them to have a call for action, so to speak, I think that's how we tried to at least push it out, and hopefully that's how it's been delivered.
I tell you what, if Graham Arnold listens to this podcast, he might just come and poach you away to pursue his own desire for a centre of football. Now, we're going to bring in from Football New South Wales the Manager of Government Relations, Funding and Infrastructure, Daniel Ristic, who you made mention of earlier, Charlotte. Let's cross now to our chat with Daniel. So, Daniel, before we get into the Hills football situation, tell us about your role. How long have you been at Football New South Wales, and what department and how many staff do you work with on a daily basis?
Yeah, excellent. Thanks, Teo. Look, I'm part of the government relations, or the facility and advocacy team, as we call it here at Football New South Wales. I've been in the role now for just under 8 years here at Football New South Wales, so had a bit of experience working with local councils and other state sporting organisations previously in my time before here at Football New South Wales, but yeah, been here now for a fraction under 8 years, here to help our role here at Football New South Wales, to help our clubs and associations, you know, collaborate with councils, state and federal MPs, working on infrastructure, working on funding, grants, anything that we can support our clubs and associations, get further funding for their facility, because we know facilities are such a core part of competitions, training that every club does. We need to make sure that we have the best quality we can for our participants out there.
This is a subject that a lot of people in football, regardless of whether they're participants, parents, fans, they love to talk about government funding, they love to talk about facilities, but you're actually hands-on making a practical difference every day, and you have done for a long time. So give us sort of a reality check of where we're at, how challenging, and sort of, you know, how much work is every little win and some of the big wins that you've had along the way.
Yeah, look, it certainly, I said, it is a big project, and it will be a continual project. There's never enough infrastructure, never enough fields for football, being the biggest sport, not only in New South Wales, but in the country. Facilities is a big part of that. And, you know, just a couple of high-level stats. We know in New South Wales, one in five change rooms are female-friendly, as an example. So we've got a long way to go to get that to where it should be for our female participants. And we know off the back of this World Cup that we've just had, as Charlotte spoke about, in the Hills area and also the other areas across New South Wales and Sydney, we've seen a big increase in the number of females playing. And so we need to make sure that we have facilities that are fit for purpose for females and for males, of course, moving forward. We're getting growth areas, particularly at the Hills area, the southwest area of Sydney as well, where we're getting more and more people coming into new areas. We need to make sure if we've got facilities there ready for them to participate, because we know it's particularly at the young age, in that 5 to 12 age bracket, that's when a lot of participants are playing our game. We need to make sure we want to try and keep them in our sport for as long as possible. And facilities play a big part of that. If they're turning up to a facility that's not in good quality or not enough facilities to cater for the need of our sport, they're going to leave our sport and go somewhere else. So we want to make sure that the facilities, we're creating experience for them as they play, whether it's under fives in the Hills area or whether you're playing over 45s in Dubbo, that the facilities that they are playing at and enjoying are going to keep them at in that club or in the sport for a long period of time.
Let's narrow the focus to the Hills home of football. As far as a scale of a project, the ambitions of a project, and what it will represent to both the Hills region and also football in New South Wales, where does it rank on in terms of the sort of the projects that your department has taken on in your 8 years at Football New South Wales?
Yeah, it's a huge project and an important project for Heels and for every association. It's one of our key pillars in our New South Wales football infrastructure strategy that we compiled in 2019-2020. Homes of football are a key part of delivering sport for our associations. And as Charlotte did mention, a number of associations already have their own home of football, where they have their fields, where they have their administration buildings, etc. That's where their home is and where they're based for that association. Heels are trying to do that same thing as well right now. They're in essence homeless at the moment, and they need a place where they can come together in one area, combined with Heels United, their MPL partner, to ensure they've got a venue that they can build on moving forward. Homes of football are really, as I said, they're a key to the association and their ability to run the sport. It's certainly one of the bigger projects that we're working on with our associations at the moment. We've been supporting Charlotte now for the last 12, 18 months now, developing a business case for her, showing her some examples, providing examples to her of what other associations are doing across the state. Because I guess that's a big part of where we come in and provide that support and information for associations, because we know what has worked elsewhere in Sydney or in regional areas and what hasn't worked, to make sure that when we're building the next home of football, being the Heels Association, that we have a facility that's going to meet the need not only today but for the next 10, 15, 20 years moving forward, particularly in an area like the Heels Shire Council, where growth of the population is just, it's just bursting at the seams. There's more people coming into the area. We need to ensure with Charlotte and the Heels Association that they can cope with the increase in demand that they're going to that they're already receiving and that they will receive over the next 10 to 15 years, because that's where a number of the population is certainly going to grow in the area. So we've put together an infrastructure strategy for the Heels Football Association a few years ago. The Home of Football was one of the key projects that sat in that infrastructure strategy for them, and now that's certainly developing and moving forward for the association. And hopefully in the next couple of months, there's a bit of a step forward for them, where they've got some issues with land classification where it sits now, and hopefully that can be transferred to the Heels Shire Council, and then we can start moving forward with design plans and working out exactly what they need there to ensure that the association can participate properly moving forward. So yeah, it's certainly a big project for us. We know we deal here, Football New South Wales, with anything from club looking to upgrade lights, or we're looking at the Heels of Football Association and then working with them putting together a home of football. And a really good example of that, I guess, is the work that's happened at Bayside Council recently in Barton Park, formerly the St George Stadium. It's obviously had a lot of history with football, but that site is almost a replica of what Heels Football are looking at moving forward as well. So one of the things that I kind of preach to a lot of associations is that they should be having what Football New South Wales has here at Valentine Sports Park, at a miniature level from what we have here, to ensure they can make and do what they need to do in the operation of football within their area. It's such a key component of football participation and football in general.
Well, you mentioned Barton Park. I just want to ask you, using that maybe as a starting point, what are some of the other sort of stake in the ground wins that your department has helped other associations and also the game broadly to facilitate in recent times?
Yeah, Barton Park's obviously a great example of what can happen for football and what football needs in an association level and an MPL level. Christie Park has been one that's the home of Northwest Sydney Football Association. That's been a project that had been on the cards for some time for the association. I'd actually worked just before I started here at Football New South Wales is at Ryde Council, working on that project from the other end, and so obviously being able to kind of transform that knowledge from council and move myself into here at Football New South Wales, and we saw the development of that facility, those synthetic fields that have been built there have been used to their maximum, which is great to see. The club's thriving, have just built a new amenities building there, which is catering for the size of that association and that venue, which is fantastic to see. We're seeing the Southern Districts Association at Ernie Smith Oval working. They're looking to put together a synthetic field, some other field upgrades and some amenity upgrades there to enhance their home of football as well. And so, you know, we're across so many projects here. The associations obviously are doing all the legwork and all the running around, getting all that work done. I guess we sit in the background and help support them with some evidence base and data that we have here at Football New South Wales that we can show and advise them. They can give that information to their relevant council or state MP or federal MP to ensure they've actually got a business case and some reasonings why they need, whether it's a home of football or whether it's a lighting upgrade or a field upgrade at a certain field. It's the opportunity that we provide is giving that data and evidence base, because that's what state government wants and federal government wants now. They want to see why does our sport need it? And we've got that data. We've got the numbers that shows where our growth is, where we're experiencing great growth, where we feel this growth going to come in the future and the demand is going to come in the future. So that support in the background, letters of support, that information that associations may or may not have already. We just give them some guidance and have a, I guess, oversee a lot of the projects as well, particularly from a design perspective. And obviously being here at Football New South Wales, we see a number of different designs for various projects. Like I've mentioned, obviously the likes of Barton Park, Christie Park, to name a few. We can see what's worked, what hasn't worked, and now working with the Hills Football Association, we can say, well, go to Barton Park and have a look at, we'll connect you with Bayside Council and the club there to say, have a look at their change rooms, have a look at their grandstand, have a look at their field, whatever it might be, to say, this is great, this has worked well, but this may not have worked well, so let's stay away from this and change this to suit your needs, to ensure that your facility is going to, you know, hopefully be the best in the Hills and the best in Sydney moving forward.
And for any relevant people within an association or a club who've heard this conversation and want to know more about your team and how the protocols of, you know, contacting Football New South Wales and those lines of communication work, what's generally the way that a dialogue starts and is maintained between your department and either associations or clubs?
Yeah, I guess the best way to get in touch with us, either myself or James Benedakis, who a colleague of mine that works in the facilities and advocacy team, is just pick up the phone and give us a call. We're here to help from a project perspective. Let us know what you're doing, what you're trying to do, and we can guide you in the right way, I guess, moving forward, because sometimes clubs and associations probably a bit raw to the whole project management of how this works and where do they need to start. We can give them that base and say, let's start from the ground up. Let's work out what you want to do. Let's put together a strategy if that's required. Let's put together some documentation that's going to help you gain the funding, because I guess a number of the clubs and associations have got, I guess, some pipe dreams of what they would like to see. The biggest issue is funding and where they're going to get that funding from. And as one of the things that I preach a lot to our clubs and associations is being prepared for particularly grants that will open up in the future. By being planned and ensuring exactly they know exactly what they are going to do moving forward is so crucial when they're applying for a grant. Because I've seen, having been on grant assessment panels for a number of years, I've seen the good and the bad and the ugly of grant applications, and it's certainly important for those clubs to understand that they need to be planned exactly how much money they require, what they are looking to do well and truly before a grant opportunity is available. So that's where James and I come into the opportunity to help our clubs and associations, we can get them started on that role and put guide them in the right direction, give them the right information and provide what they need to gain that funding to hopefully update and upgrade their facilities in the future. So yeah, best way to just pick up the phone, give Football New South Wales a call, we can connect, and they can connect us straight to us, and we can go from there and keep that relationship going. And I guess that's the key part for us, is we want to be as much as across any project as we can, by letting us know where you're up to, where you can be, and we can, you know, guide you through those processes and those loopholes that might be coming up for those clubs and associations that are looking to upgrade facilities.
Well, Daniel Ristich, it's a vital part of providing football in the state of New South Wales and across its hundreds of thousands of participants. Thanks for jumping in the pod and keep up the good work.
Awesome. Thanks, Teo.
Stay with us on the Football New South Wales Community Podcast. We're going to talk about the Parramatildas, and one of their players, Tamsin Colley, will be joining us next.
Welcome back to the Football New South Wales Community Podcast. My co-host for this episode is General Manager of Hills Football, Charlotte Ursell, and it's time to welcome our next guest, Tamsin Colley. Charlotte, I'll let you do the introduction. Tamsin Colley, what do we need to know?
Tamsin, one of my players within the Parramatildas. She's got many hats also, much like me. Uni student, there's a whole list, I'm sure you'll read off it, but uni student, footballer, a pure athlete, if you will, but I'd prefer her to go through all of her accolades because she's quite a successful athlete.
Tamsin joins us on the line. Great to have you on the podcast, Tamsin.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm honored to share my story and be honest.
So we're talking to you as part of the recently completed Female Football Week. Obviously, some of the great initiatives taking place, and we have a number of people to acknowledge. But tell us a bit about yourself and your journey in football, Tamsin.
So my journey, as Charlotte said, I'm a para footballer with also, many hats. I'm like a uni student and stuff. But I started football when I was younger with actually another person who's on the coaching staff of the Parramatildas, Kim, who was my coach at the Pink Koalas disability team. Yes, so I will enjoy that and love the game. But, unfortunately, there was no real pathways for people with cerebral palsy to pursue it competitively then. And then only in the last few years when the Parramatildas got created, there was, more opportunities. And then I got fortunately selected for the Parramatildas at the Parasia Cup, which is cool. And I also play in my local club, Helston Park. So I really enjoyed that on the weekends and training during the week. So, yeah.
I recall going to Cromer Park for the Pararoos hadn't played in Australia for 19 years, and they played a friendly against Canada, and all the chat was, we need a women's team. We need a Parramatildas as well. Tamsin, given the evolution of football and providing the game to people of all abilities, what did it mean when the Parramatildas program was started, and what does it mean to you to be a part of it?
It was such an incredible thing. I had also that thought, I was watching the Pros growing up and thought, why isn't there a women's team yet? But it was already in the works. And then luckily, when I heard about that, I was following it eagerly, and then decided to take my shot and ramped up my training and try to get in, which I was lucky enough to do. So yeah, it's just so great. And to see people like you representing your country, it makes you feel like you can do it, you can't be it if you can't see it. So yeah.
And I guess, Tamsin, where it's at now is definitely not how it always was. And it's scary to think when we actually launched, I think it was the 7th of March in 2022, and a couple of months later. So this time 2 years ago, we're in Spain. So between March and May, we'd established a whole team and we were overseas competing at, as the Parramatildas. But I guess fun fact for everyone, and I know you mentioned Kim, Tamsin, she was involved in the start with me. So here at Football New South Wales, I guess prior to my role at Hills, when I was Inclusion Diversity Coordinator, we ran a Come and Try Day in 2017, December, and we in 2018 had a development program or development camp, and we had some international Japanese players come over, and that was essentially the start of kind of what was to come. So we've been building on it since then, and I established a New South Wales program, which I know is still running, and Kelly Sturton, who's the head coach and I'm her assistant, she was here over the weekend running one of those sessions, so it's still running, but that's essentially where it came from. So here at VSP is, you know, what fostered this whole national team. It sounds a bit crazy, and again, we don't talk about it too much, and I think people probably just know the establishment of that national team again 2 years ago, but it was a build-up since 2017, and again, it all started here. Tamsin has been involved in it from the start as well, and most of our starting players have been involved as well since then, and a lot of them have played mainstream, they've played with boys, they've played other sports. I'll let Tamsin touch on it, but a lot of the players are all coming from different worlds and lives and abilities, journeys, different disability levels. It's the most interesting thing to watch as a coach as well, but I'll let Tamsin touch on that. Do you want to tell us about your journey? You obviously started in athletics and you've got quite a successful career.
Yeah, okay. So I started, I did power athletics when I was growing up. My first Come and Try Day was actually when I was like 6, because my mum came from a physio background and like was looking for ways to keep me active and improve my rehab from a brain tumor I got removed when I was younger. And that was the main support available for people with disabilities, ambulant people with physical disabilities, particularly to pursue sport at a competitive level. So I went through the school system and that, and actually was fortunate to be selected for the Paralympics in Rio 2016. That was a huge honor, and I'm just so grateful I had that experience, and then that spurred me on, I guess, to think that I could to be motivated to get there again with the Paratillers. So it'd be a dream come true if I got to like a World Cup. The Asia Cup last year was like a great start. So looking forward to my future here.
What position does Tamsin play, and what's the main instruction you have to give her when you are coaching?
I guess to start with, we play 5v5, so it's a little bit different. The boys play 7v7. So in terms of positions, it does change quite often. And Tamsin has come into the fold, like she mentioned, with the Asian Cup that was in October last year. So that was her one of her main tournaments. And so in terms of coaching-wise, it's a little bit different. I won't talk too much about it, but all the players have different classifications based on their disability. So Tamsin, do you want to touch on your classification and how it works in terms of the classification process?
Yeah, sure. So there's three classification in cerebral palsy football, the FT1-3. I'm an FT1, which is like the my type of cerebral palsy affects like all four limbs and two are greater extent, you could say, as some others. Like in all the passports, there's different classification systems, so it's cool to see this one. And then you can only have one FT3, which is the least impaired on the field at once, and must have one FT1, and you can have as many twos as you like. So yeah, the classification is a interesting dynamic, but it is good to make the team like more fair. So I'm an FT1, as I said.
That experience at the home of the Matildas, playing in front of those crowds, I mean, I guess if you've been to a Paralympics, it probably in terms of the size and the scale of the event, not nearly as big, but given that the nation is being swept up by women's football, by the Matildas, by the A-League Women's, how did it feel to have those crowds cheering for you and the Paramatildas as well?
Yeah, it was really an unreal experience. Like, I always think the Asia Championships last year, the Asia Cup was like better for me than the Paralympics, because I guess everyone, like my whole family, could come and watch because it was a home game. And just, yeah, being in the sport I love, it was so good. And yeah, just like all the friends could come and support you, and being with like the whole team of people who like you've been in this journey together, and they all like bring each other up. So yeah, that was unreal, and I was able to score 4 goals in that tournament, and we actually went ahead and won it, which was really exciting. So yeah.
As far as what's next for the team, what's on the calendar and what are you looking forward to?
Oh, so many things. Where do I start? We do have another World Cup in November this year. That's in Spain. So we did go to Spain 2 years ago. So same location. There will be more teams. So our first time there was around the time where a lot of other female teams were starting for the first time. So it's not unique just to the Paramatildas. It was the other countries as well. So I think we had 5 when we were there 2 years ago. We just got a list the other day from our team manager. I think there's 7 listed. There's possibly more. So more countries essentially participating, which is excellent and exciting as well. And between now and then, we've got 2 more camps. We do have a development type of camp as well. So nationals as well as facilitated during the September school holiday. So historically, and again, this is many, many years ago, it always used to be here at VSP as well. They share the love now. So I think last year it was in Perth. I think it'll be in Canberra this year as well. So we use those tournaments whilst they're on home soil to either identify players, watch them in the boys' space as well, because they do play 7v7, or we use it during that time whilst we're all together to put on either sessions or a camp if we can.
Now, I'm going to get to these Female Football Week awards. The Football New South Wales Awards. Referee of the Year was Frieda Maher of the Canterbury Referees Association. Female Coach of the Year was Zainab Jaber of the Banksia Tigers and Football St George. Female Volunteer of the Year, Robin Churchland from Orange Waratah Soccer Club. Community Champion of the Year was Carl Baker from Bradmery Ambervale Football Club. And Female Player of the Year, both for New South Wales and for Australia for Female Football Week, is our guest, Tamsin Colley. Tamsin, how did you find out that you'd been acknowledged as the Female Player of the Year for Female Football Week, and what was your reaction?
So I was so thrilled to receive it. It was like so unexpected and an incredible honour. I found out, well, my club, Helston Park, I was blown away by their lovely nomination of me. They like ran it by. I just got a phone call the day it was announced, the morning on social media. So then, I was notified that I won both the New South Wales and Australian Player of the Year awards, and I couldn't believe it. So, it was just really exciting. All credit goes to my wonderful club, Helston Park, and like everyone who supported me, because it was them who pushed me to be the best player I can be. Yeah, and also to be a power footballer winning it is so special. Like, I'm not sure if there's been any power footballers before, but it's just so great to have that representation. And if I was growing up and would see like a someone with a disability winning an award like this, it would be like, whoa, I definitely want to be them.
And Charlotte, tell us about Tamsin's football. Why do you think Tamsin was recognised with this award?
Oh, I think Tamsin has grown from strength to strength. She's already mentioned Helston Park Wanderers, which are quite a relatively large club, doing all the good things. They're very inclusive. In my previous role here at Football New South Wales, I was around or working during that time in that role when they started their All Abilities program. So I'm not surprised that they're fostering, participants like Tamsin within a women's team. I think, Tamsin, you're also part of the Kick On for Women program that they run as well, which, again, I mentioned previously, that we do run some of those in the hills also. So in terms of the football side of things, it's quite prevalent that she's excellent on the field, but she's also advocating off the field. I think that's also a key part to this. So advocating for not just disability sport or para footballers, depending on which way you want to look at it, but also just female football as a whole. So we're always looking for those champions, and I know everyone that you've listed previously in terms of the winners, they're recognised for a reason, and Tamsin is no different.
Tamsin, congratulations. Continue your great work on the pitch and off, and hopefully we see your name scoring plenty of goals as the Parramatildas continue into the future.
Thank you so much.
I have one final question.
Yes, go for it.
Who's your favourite coach, Tamsin?
All my coaches are really great.
Great answer. So political. I love it.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us, Tamsin.
Thank you. It was great. Thanks.
Big thanks to our guest, Tamsin Colley, the Female Player of the Year, both in New South Wales and also nationally for Female Football Week. And again, congratulations to everyone who's been recognised in those categories. Just quickly, Charlotte, how important is Female Football Week, but also, you know, the celebration and recognition of people that makes such a big difference?
Oh, look, if it was up to me, Female Football Week would be every weekend. You know, we only allocate 2 weeks of the calendar year, but I think it's important to showcase not just the people that are winning awards like this, and Tamsin is obviously one of them that we've just spoken to, but it's the champions, it's what we're doing on the pitch, it's what we're doing off the pitch, it's all the types of initiatives. It's the highlight of the calendar year, in my personal opinion. We do obviously do other things outside of that two-week window, but it's just important to recognise a period of time where it's also within the men's space. So, for example, in the Hills, you know, we have an all-female crew in our men's games as well across that weekend, and we try and encourage both sides of it and to showcase it to all sides of the game. But it's just important to recognise those that are truly doing things in the background, and we like to highlight those that are not just successful players scoring lots of goals, you know, coaches that are successful. It's those that are doing the hard work that, you know, don't always get that recognition that we like to highlight. And, you know, sometimes we might need to tap people on the shoulder to get those names and details. But, you know, when you're working in an association, you're across kind of all the things. So we try and make sure that we acknowledge those people. And it very easily rolls into National Volunteer Week as well, which kicks off this week. So I guess they go hand in hand, and I think the timing of it is excellent.
That brings us to the almost to the end of this edition of the Football New South Wales Community Podcast. But short term on your calendar, what are some of the things near on the horizon that you're looking forward to ticking off with Hills? You know, not even before the end of the season, the immediate things that you'll be, you know, both embracing as challenges, but also looking forward to doing.
Yeah, of course. Look, working with council and again, Daniel, who we've mentioned already, and all other bodies, more so the government bodies that are assisting us in getting access to land for the Home of Football, big ticket item. That's probably our biggest project at the moment. And we are, you know, pushing with particular ministers such as, you know, the sports minister shortly, and all other areas to make sure that we can get access to the land. That's number one. Separate to that, that's the Home of Football, but just getting access to other playing venues, which again will come online probably in the next for next season, at least in North Kellyville, and then in the next couple of years Box Hill. So that's a big ticket item. Again, like I mentioned, the growth in that North Ward is huge, so we just need to cater to the demand. We never like to turn people away, so we're trying to figure out ways that we can adapt. So that's our biggest task at the moment. Separate to that, you know, increasing our coach education courses, referee courses is ongoing. We like to do those, like most associations, at the start of the year, but we're continuing to push those as well. And again, like I mentioned, with the pathways, working with Hills United on the pitch and off the pitch is also something that's, you know, happening naturally, but, you know, working collaboratively together is always a good sign, particularly with, you know, associations and pathways clubs like Hills United. So they're the main big ticket items. So that fills up a lot of my time, as you can imagine.
Charlotte Ursell, thanks so much for joining us and your insights as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back with another community podcast soon. However, I would encourage all of you listening to go back to some of the previous episodes with some of the different associations and also some of the sessions from this year's Football New South Wales Club Conference. We've got an episode on volunteers and player and spectator behaviour, which you can tune into now. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't miss our next update. I've been your host, Teo Pellizzeri. Thanks for your company. This has been the Football New South Wales Community Podcast. We'll speak to you again soon.